It's Wednesday, May the 31st, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Brian Fanning is Professor of Migration and Social Policy at University College Dublin. He's written a number of important books on contemporary Irish society and thought. His new book, Public Morality and the Culture Wars, The Triple Divide, sets out to look at the divisions over issues of rights and identity that are currently convulsing some societies, particularly the United States, but not just there, and that seem to be growing louder here as well. Brian, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me on board. And it's actually my birthday today, Wednesday.
Oh, happy birthday to you. The one thing that struck me immediately when I opened the book was that an awful lot of your work in the past has been around issues of multiculturalism, the changing face of Irish society, questions of migration. They often figure in the culture wars, but that's not your focus in this book.
In a sense, pretty much everything I've ever done has had in a dialogue of sorts with other things I've done. So my last book on Ireland was called Diverse Republic. And it's about how Ireland has changed and become a much more diverse society in terms of where people are from, skin colour, culture, in that broad sense. But it was also basically looking at the kinds of sense that some people may feel left behind by some of these changes and the idea of diversity as something that we think of as a good thing. But there's also diversity of opinion. And one of the challenges of our 21st century societies, including Ireland, is how do we actually deal with diversity of opinion at a time when pretty much everybody can shout in everybody else's ear with the internet and so on. So in a sense, we're being bombarded with messages from, in a way perhaps previous generations would not have, from people who have worldviews we might disagree with. So do we censor these? What do we do about them? How do we come to terms with the various ideas that are floating around? So these things are all part of the complexity of 21st century societies, which are diverse in a number of different ways, including diversity about belief. And I think that's quite important too. So in essence, this particular book, it's been with me a long, long time because I've been thinking about some of these issues perhaps for two decades. I became very interested in the idea of public morality, which is the idea that you can enforce your preferred moral values through law. And we did that in the past in Ireland. Up to the very recent past, it was a Catholic country for a Catholic people with a Catholic constitution. And we have various referenda that have changed bits and pieces of that. So in a sense, up till very recently, we would have understood that as a move away from a sort of a Catholic public morality, where Catholic ideas, ideas that are religious ideas, are encoded in our laws and constitution, to perhaps a liberal version of it that would be more the idea of a personal morality. But we've now also begun to pivot towards perhaps new forms of public morality that are very much built around what progressive ideas of what it is to have an inclusive society, a good society. And the champions of these kind of advocate coding these into our law, into our practices and so on and so forth. So we would have hate crime legislation and so on being mooted at the moment. And the idea here is that we have a certain sense of what constitutes a good society that is perhaps shared by many people. And the idea is then that if politicians would see that it is popular to encode some of this in the law, to pass various laws that basically, if you will, make these part of the public morality of say, our society today. So the culture wars are really about a battle for ideas and a battle of ways of thinking that lie behind all of this. And there have been these have been shifting over decades in many different places.
So there's a huge amount in that to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
But there's let's look at the Irish example, which you touched on there. You make some interesting comparisons between, I suppose, two different Irish Catholic churches, the Catholic Church in Ireland and the Catholic Church in the United States, which was essentially an Irish church as well, in that most of the people who wielded power within it and ran it actually were Irish or came from an Irish background. And in the United States, partly because Catholics were a minority, the position of the church within society and the way it presented itself on issues of law and individual rights and individual conscience was very different, as we know, from what it was in Ireland. And in Ireland, you make the point, which I think is very well made, and people don't remark enough upon it, that the purpose of what was some people would call the theocratic state of the first 50 years or so of the Free State was not to force non-Catholics to behave like Catholics. It was to upholster, to bolster the Catholicism of the 93% of the population who describe themselves as Catholic. And the thing I wonder about that, reading it, is there are conservative commentators now who are in the losing minority, you might say, on some of these culture war issues in Ireland currently, who make an argument, and sometimes it seems facile to me and sometimes there seems to be something to it, which is that all that's happened is that the situation has flipped, and that the new dispensation, the new moral code, is just as conformist, just as authoritarian. That seems a push to me. But the argument is made that there is a kind of a mirror image that has happened here. Do you think at all there's any truth in that?
Okay, the first of all, the sort of debates we're talking about can only take place in democratic societies. So these are essentially open societies where people get to argue about their beliefs in some form of public sphere, whether it's radio, whether it's podcasts, whether it's the Twitter, whether it's books. So ideas basically come up against each other. The idea of a Catholic public morality for Ireland certainly influenced me in thinking about the book. There was a sociologist who also became Bishop of Limerick, Catholic Bishop Jeremiah Newman. And he was a sociologist back in the 60s, but he also was a political philosopher. And he wrote a book on public morality and Catholicism. And his big question was, you know, is the church right to impose a Catholic public morality on a mostly Catholic society? And he concluded, yes. Is the church right to try and do the same in the United States? And he concluded, no. Now, the argument there is basically a pragmatic one. Because Catholics were a minority in essentially a Protestant-influenced United States, Protestant-Christian, what Catholics benefited from most was freedom of speech. Similar things played out in Germany in response to the Kulturkampf, which was basically kind of the repression of Catholics who were, you know, in Bismarckian Germany before the First World War. So in some context, in democratic countries, religious minorities tend to side with free speech because it's their best protection against the state. And often the state that they want to be protected against is one that has an antipathy towards religion or hostility towards it. So basically, in a sense, kind of people with strong beliefs find liberals to be their natural allies when they're in the minority. But when those people become majorities, they're tempted to go the other direction. So on the other side of the coin, organizations such as the American Council of Civil Liberties, you know, which set up over a century ago, you know, used to defend the free speech rights of the KKK because it argued unless deplorables like the Ku Klux Klan could have their free speech rights defended, what hope had trade unionists and others of getting their free speech protected also? But, you know, in recent years, you don't see much about free speech in that sense on the website of the ACLU, who are mostly dedicated, like many such organizations in the 21st century, to promoting progressive values as they understand them to be, because these are the good values that they would aspire to. And they don't need to get into an alliance with liberals anymore, as in free speech supporting liberals, to achieve that, because they're already in a position of some dominance. So in a sense, basically, this is like one of those movies where people change sides halfway through and, you know, X is with Y and then Y is with Z and then, you know, it kind of goes back and forth a bit. But the axiom here is this, is that when people who have strong moral values or strong codes that they believe should be enforceable are in the majority, they tend to go ahead with it if they can. And then basically, if they're in the minority, they tend to look towards liberals, free speech and rights to protect their minority values. So what we're seeing here basically is a sort of a new natural alliance between conservatives and liberals against progressives, in the sense that people are progressive about certain social issues that are regarded perhaps as unnerving for some.
These are such slippery terms. Maybe you could just tell me what you mean by conservatives, liberals and progressives.
I'm a big believer in not kind of putting large numbers of people into a particular category, although those are shorthands. So by conservative, essentially, I guess I would mean people whose belief systems are rooted perhaps in Christian conservatism in one shape or form. And that would include a range of beliefs that are very different from the kinds of beliefs that would be perhaps associated with many people today who describe themselves as progressive or secular. So those are beliefs about the human person, when life begins, the idea of a soul, the idea of original sin in particular is a very important one. you know, there's an anecdote I heard from a friend once, so I'll repeat it here. It might be true, it might be apocryphal. So Mr. Chesterton, the great philosopher, Catholic philosopher of the early 20th century, was asked, Mr. Chesterton, what would you do to fix the problems of society? And he looked and eyeballed the journalist and he said, I would look first to my own sinful nature. I would clean my own room, that kind of thing. Mm. So basically, accepting that moral fault and moral flaw and that the sins and evils of a terrible world are, can only be negotiated at the level of the self, who takes moral responsibility for that. So original sin, basically, or the idea that we're imperfect. Contrast that with Enlightenment ideas since Rousseau, where the idea is that we're children of nature, perfect in every way until interfered with by terrible things, from the terrible influences from the outside world. So we have a self that has to be curated and protected from the world. And it understands harm very differently. And this is the other big idea, is that, you know, somebody who is perhaps of conservative values would perhaps look to a certain idea about morality. It's actually quite complex, and I think often people who are progressive or liberal misunderstand how absolutely complex and multi-layered conservative ideas about morality can actually be. There's a fantastic book on that topic by a guy called Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind that I would really recommend anybody to read. It's certainly one that influenced me a fair bit, and I stopped in my tracks after reading that and rethinking certain things about conservatives. So people who are progressive are essentially, that's a term that's crept in very recently, again, into usage. We use it in a certain kind of way now. There are things like woke also put about, but that tends to be a slur. But the idea that basically people have progressive values, they believe in the idea of social and societal progress. And they believe essentially that that we can have a fair amount of social and institutional change to achieve that. But there's also a sense that the problems people experience them are outside of themselves. So that we can blame, I don't know, neoliberalism, or we can blame various social forces for the terrible things that people do. So it's like you're in front of the court and you say, I'm sorry about the crimes I committed, judge, but society made me do it. That would be very much a post-Rousseauian idea. Whereas basically somebody else going to the courts and saying, I'm sorry for my crimes, judge, my sinful nature made me do it, I accept my punishment, would be a different point of view. Now I'm just doing a cartoon here. Liberals... If I think of the classic conservative, I think of St. Augustine. If I think of perhaps the classic liberal, as in the free speech liberal, I'm thinking of the 19th century, I'm thinking of John Stuart Mill in particular. And I guess if people are thinking about who progressives are today, they sometimes cite figures such as Judith Butler. So Judith Butler is a philosopher who has become incredibly influential in basically articulating essentially a postmodern perspective that ourselves are created, entirely socially constructed, can be imagined and reimagined. So that's a sort of a strain of emancipatory thinking that really, you know, dates before her to figures such as Freud, even Nietzsche, go back to Rousseau, and so on and so forth. So there is this sort of Enlightenment idea that basically we can imagine the emancipation of the self as a human project, and as a project to be defended and supported, so which is a very different one than the one articulated by conservatives. Whereas liberalism, in a sense, is about more about free speech than either of those values. You could have liberals who are conservatives, you could have liberals who are progressives. And I always, you know, the cover of my book has three people looking away from each other on the cover. But the point of it is that in reality, most of us are Venn diagrams, as in we're always a combination of more than one set of these
views. I mean,
we have
to speak in broad strokes, or else this podcast would be 24 days long.
John Miller is the classic free speech liberal who basically argues that free speech and the articulation of ideas is good for society because it allows for the best transfer of knowledge and ideas that allows us to tease through very complicated issues, and that there are benefits to us all for basically allowing and protecting free speech, even when it's uncomfortable.
So at the heart of the book, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, the subtitle of the book is The Triple Divide. And the Triple Divide is the three strands of thought which you've described there. Mm. But because it's a new thing, I think you argue in the book, the new thing is the split, I suppose you could say, between what has often been a traditional coalition of liberals and progressives in terms of the political and social history of the Western democracies, which we're discussing here, but that they're starting to diverge and maybe to clash.
Yeah, you see that happening in various ways. The first thing to bear in mind is that an awful lot of the most bitter fights in the culture wars, to use the term loosely, are between people who are very close or near ideological neighbours. They're people who are parts of the same groups. So sometimes these are battles for the control or dominance of a certain group in the way that you might have found it perhaps in a socialist movement in the past where the Trotskyists are trying to oust the Leninists or whatever, or indeed in a religious organization where a certain kind of a branch of theology claims dominance over another one and there's some form of schism and so on. So often these are fights between near neighbors. Now, if we were to kind of think of the culture wars just in terms of basically battles between liberals and conservatives in the way that we think of it mostly in terms of the United States, we would miss much of the action that takes place, say, in other parts of the Anglophone world, which is far less religious than the United States. So if we look at the United Kingdom, for example, where, you know, there would be ongoing heavy coverage of culture war issues and quite a lot of frenzy about this online, we would basically look and sort of say, who are these people who are you know, at each other's throats on Twitter or wherever? They're people who used to write for The Guardian against people who write for The Guardian still. They're people who are in kind of left of centre parties. There are people who thought of themselves as feminists for all their adult lives. You know, so
kind of, not entirely. There are also members of the Conservative Party. There are also columnists for the Daily Mail.
And these people are rowing in and basically seeing an opportunity here, which is very welcome for them at this moment in time. Because here's the other thing too, I guess, and this is basically is, you know, I think a lot of people who kind of write or even read things would be quite careful about, you know, the provenance of the information that comes their way. So if you're on the left, you're not going to read something that you associate with the far right. You know, if you're a Guardian reader, you might be skeptical of the Telegraph and so on and so forth. So when you see people who once espoused liberal or progressive views now, say, for example, publishing columns in the Telegraph attacking woke or something like that, you would say, what on earth's going on? Well, certainly there's political hay to be made on the right with the apparent intolerance of some progressives towards what used to be fairly centrist and uncontroversial positions.
What sort of position?
I think the controversial one, the one that basically gets everybody upset, is the one about the difference, sex differences, which I think most of us and certainly previous generations of feminism would have argued are very important. So sex differences are differences between men and women as they play out in the economy, in the family, in terms of sport and elsewhere. So there are such things as sex inequalities, and these need to be studied. Then we get the idea of gender, which then becomes a very, very complex bunch of ideas. But gender essentially is a sort of an understanding of a role, according to the classic feminists or the second wave feminists, who we would have basically mostly considered as feminists up till recently. And quite recently, we now have feminists who have basically very much sided with sort of thinkers like Judith Butler in arguing that gender itself, the fact that gender itself is socially constructed, that we can reimagine our gender roles, and therefore that we have people who have very clear, create identities for themselves in relation to that are gender identities, that this is something that needs to be taken very seriously, in terms of law, in terms of respect for others, in terms of equality, and so on and so forth. But all of these kind of conflicts and battles kind of, in most circumstances, you could imagine it quite easy for people to live alongside one another, all protected by the same rights. But activists on both sides have identified areas where they agree that, where they sort of see zero-sum games, really. Zero-sum games.
So they're not looking for compromise or common ground.
I think there are people who make their living out of basically expressing ideas very, very strongly. You don't get as many likes for a post that says, oh, on one hand, and then, okay, on the other hand, no. You get a lot of likes for a post that will appeal to a lot of people by expressing a strong view. So in this context, conservatives can kind of sit back, perhaps, the British Conservative Party being an example, the Republican Party in the States, and make hay with this, in a sense, because what they can now argue is that progressives are intolerant. And to some extent, that holds up in some contexts. In others, it's a misreading of what goes on. But certainly there would be hostages to fortune out there. And I'm thinking of various cases where some academics have been censured in the UK by their trade unions and by their students, essentially for holding certain types of views. Whereas there would be others who would argue that the university can't function properly unless ideas of free speech are an academic freedom, which again is a very, it's not free speech, it's a very other very,
very
distinct,
specific kind of idea.
In other words, ideas and views that you can back up with evidence and your research, that those things should be protected. So we have some very heated debates, and obviously, we see then the potential for other groups to exploit these. Yeah,
I suppose listening to that, one of the things that occurs to me is that the idea of an illiberal or intolerant left is not a new one. We've always had those movements with us. And in fact, millions of people have suffered under extremely autocratic, illiberal, left-wing regimes of one sort or another. Yeah. So that divide has always been there. So what's new about this?
I think what's new about this is who's driving the car, or who potentially is in charge, or who's doing the shaping of the moment, of the debates at the moment. Like in Ireland, say some decades ago, you know, public morality the tone was set by conservatives. In the early 21st century after 9/11, you had a version of liberalism, which I would call muscular liberalism, others too, which demanded we be intolerant of those who are intolerant of our freedoms. So it was very heavy-handed stuff, and would be basically tied in with quite a lot of kind of Islamophobia and lots of other things of that nature.
It's associated with the French laïcité and those kinds of ideas.
You couldn't open a newspaper for about 10 years after 9/11 without getting columnist after columnist kind of basically very shrill tones about we need to be more intolerant of Muslims.
Sure, and we had the new atheism and those kinds of movements too.
But they're liberal movements. They're not left movements. They're the liberals. So these are intolerant liberals. Mm. You know, liberals who basically make the argument, well, the philosopher Richard Rorty put it like this. He said, we have a duty to be intolerant of intolerance. Yeah. So we're now in a situation where perhaps after the great crash, after a number of other things, with the environmental movement, with an awful lot of kind of shifting ground around gender identities and also the emancipatory movements about marriage equality and other things, where the progressive values are very attractive to an awful lot of people. They articulate a version of what constitutes a good society and human flourishing. And of course, political parties, you know, will basically be drawn to people, to basically getting the votes of people who hold those beliefs and so on. So basically the question is now, are progressives being intolerant? So the argument of some people is that, yes, in some circumstances, we do see intolerance. Can controversial ideas that weren't controversial become controversial? But does that mean we should not be allowed to debate certain things? There are people who hold genuinely different views on this and would hold very, perhaps cleave to their own strong positions, but it's then made much more complicated by the internet and social media, which has accelerated and polarized opinions and created situations where some of what progressives are saying actually makes an awful lot of sense. I'm going to turn to, kind of, as a sociologist briefly, to the idea of harm. The great defense of free speech, or the great idea of free speech, which is the John Stuart Mill's idea, as interpreted by an American Supreme Court justice a long time ago, Oliver Wendell Holmes, was free speech, but no shouting fire in a crowded building. What that meant was your free speech was perfect and grand and good unless it could demonstrably harm another person. We live at a time now where people are taking wider and wider definitions of what constitutes harm, so that speech acts, you know, are basically described as harmful, as erasing, or you know, often very, very strong language is used about
violence. Speech is violence. It's not symbolic violence.
It becomes described as if it is violence. And of course, that's where we get ideas such as hate crime. So we certainly need to reckon with some of this. I think at a sociological level that the sort of, if you will, the sympathy towards this way of thinking about things kind of leans into our actual experience. I mean, you don't have to be long on Twitter or some other social media platform to feel totally burnt out and overwhelmed by ideas that you find perhaps reprehensible, things that you find upsetting and distressing, and to think, okay, this stuff isn't just on my bookshelf. I don't have to go out and actually find it. It's with me on the bus. It's with me at home. It's in front of my daughter's screen as she does her homework, you know? So in other words, basically the outside world is encroaching upon us in ways that it never did. And on the way into town today to this interview, I had a near dispute with somebody on a bus. And there was a guy sitting behind me on the bus on the 150 coming in. And he was playing music on his mobile phone rather loudly. I asked him to turn it down. And he basically said on no certain terms that I should not. And then he basically used some expletives and so on and so forth, and then he turned it up. Now, the point of it is that I kind of then said, well, okay, plenty of time. I knew I wouldn't be late. So I said, okay, if you keep doing that, I said, I'm going to ask the driver to stop the bus and call the Gardaí, and you'll be half an hour late getting to your destination. And he stopped doing it. But the point of it is that normally there are rules of conduct in public places, But the internet has kind of made everywhere a kind of a public place. So there is a need to rethink rules. So I have a lot of sympathy, you know, with basically efforts to do this. But there's another side where thinking about harm differently is the product of a very, very different way of thinking about what it is to be human than the kinds of beliefs that underpin, say, sort of Christian conservatisms of previous generations.
So you use a phrase in the book, you say therapeutic morality.
I use therapeutic individualism or therapeutic morality.
What does that mean?
Not my own idea. It comes from a guy called Philip Reif. It's been picked up mostly by religious or conservative writers who are trying to make sense of the culture wars. So they're really asking the question, what has changed fundamentally from what was to what is now, or what seems to be the case? And it's the idea that people think rather differently about themselves, the idea of the self. And one of the arguments I make in parts of the book, in the early parts of the book, is I kind of set up a background within which the culture wars we're having, the debates about free speech, even the debates about trivial things, are not trivial debates at all. Whether we know it or not, whenever we're bickering with each other on Twitter or elsewhere about these things, we're engaged in profound conversations about what it is to be a human being. So I said something about the Christian idea of the self as a sinful person, and I used the figure of St. Augustine, a very influential theologian, to kind of, if you will, create a snapshot of that. But the Rousseauian idea that basically the self is a curated thing, and basically that, you know, kind of a lot of religious ideas, especially in Christianity, gave us the idea of the individual responsible for their own sin. The individual with as a moral entity away from, say, a family or a tribe is very much a Christian idea. And then it was secularized into the Enlightenment. And then it was psychologicized by people in the 19th and 20th centuries. So the idea that we should be curating ourselves and thinking about the development of ourselves, or and the ways in which people talk about themselves as a project. You know,
a lot of people would describe that nowadays as a sort of part of the neoliberal project. In fact, I've had people on this podcast
target that very thing. There's something very neoliberal in the sense that it's hyper-individualized. But there's also a sense that, you know, okay, one of the examples I use in the book was basically came from the 1960s, and it was all this Tom Wolfe writing about G-salt therapy and all of these faddish Californian things, where people essentially were basically investing in themselves therapeutically. But the kinds of figures that he would have been writing about at the time, the people who were the adults in the 1960s who took to wearing kaftans and exploring themselves would now have died of old age. You know, we're now three or four generations into these kinds of ways of thinking. So, when you have a secular world where you're not really, where you're not a believer in a religion where essentially what you're doing is you have free will, but you're surrendering to God, you're surrendering to the idea of the good as understood by your religious beliefs, and you're putting that at the center of your life. The 12 Steps program being a hangover of perhaps that for people who aren't religious, to an idea that basically you're only responsible to yourself and your project is only yourself. So the idea that you only have yourself, you know, is emancipatory if you say, okay, now what can I do with that?
It can also be terrifying.
And it can also be terrifying. So we end up with the usual human scenario where everybody's expressing their individuality as part of tribes and organizations. You know, so they have, it's, you know, it's like I'm a mod, I'm a rocker, I'm a, you know, a ska fan or whatever. You know, you basically hang out with people who listen to the same music as you. That's what we all did as children. Certainly I did it when I was a teenager.
Although that was a cultural moment in the analog age, which now seems to be replaced by a much more complex series of identities.
In a sense, basically, you know, I don't doubt for a second that people, you know, who have beliefs about their gender identities, who identify as trans and elsewhere, are profoundly sincere about their thinking, and they should be taken extremely seriously as people for that. You know, but they're doing something slightly different up to a point than humans have done in earlier generations, but they're also doing something the same as human beings have always done.
Well, indeed, and there's a point there, which and I know that some people find it offensive when this point is made, but there is a suggestion that that some of these beliefs are sort of a new version of religion, I suppose, and that they fill, you know, the God-shaped hole is the terrible cliche, but that in some way the patterns of behavior around these beliefs are not dissimilar to the kind of behaviors that have accompanied strong religious beliefs in the past.
Well, I guess it's a bit like this for me. I'm not a religious person, although I grew up in a Catholic heritage and have a lot of respect for aspects of it. But if you tell me you have an immortal soul, I don't believe that personally. And if I asked you to show me your immortal soul, I'd have to take it on trust that you have one. in a sense, basically today we're dealing with people's we're dealing with ideas subjectively held, ultimately, right? You know, by people, and we're asking that those ideas be treated with respect. But where does the balance lie then between basically individual rights to free speech, individual rights to express opinions or to have conversations, and somebody's argument perhaps at the extreme end of, say, the progressive debate on this, that the mere expression of an idea by somebody else is harmful to me and therefore should be censored or shut down? So there's a fair bit of thinking and trashing out to be done about where the balance lies between free speech and shouting fire in a crowded building or engaging in some other acts that we would consider harmful. So, you know, certain types of racist speech or homophobic speech or transphobic speech can be deeply harmful. If I use such speech and exhort another person or a crowd to harm an individual, then that's hate speech and it has consequences that are very real and material. If I merely express an idea in a book or in a lecture, you know, and is that the same thing, you know? And if I'm not basically particularizing it to any particular individual, I'm just expressing a philosophical or something akin to a religious point of view of my own, yeah? So we have to figure out where the battle lines are, where the, how to police or manage all of this as society. Ireland at the moment, like other societies, is trying out some new legislation around this. And, you know, anybody who's followed those debates closely would say, one, there are certain commitments to this by government. At the same time, there are people who are criticizing certain aspects of these religions, worried that they will harm or undermine free speech or individual liberty into the future. And there are certain aspects of it then where basically certain wording in piece of legislation regarded as unclear, because what we're talking about is not perhaps as fully understood, because I think we're hitting a moving target all the time. So we're going to have to continue to negotiate all of these things. But it would be a certain optimism I would have is that no matter what happens, we're going to end up with a very complicated society within which people hold a wide range of views that are going to come up against one another. If we have democratic societies, there's kind of no way other than having that. And what we really need then are rules that basically allow people to be treated fairly and justly while striking some kind of balance. And we need to try this in good faith. So, you know, it's all part of a journey. There's a thesis and antithesis, a synthesis, and back and forth it goes again. So we're trying to understand a very fast-changing world as it changes. And that's an entirely good thing. And that's entirely in line with, say, something like John Mill would say, you know, that you really need to basically try and make sense of the world by using all the information around you. But if we get to a phase where we're deliberately shutting out or shutting down a significant section of the population or particular points of view, especially ones that would have been regarded as fairly mainstream not very recently, then we're doing ourselves a potential damage as a society. And we're also basically feeding a narrative that says that this stuff is coercive and it can fuel a backlash. So in a sense, you know, there are people out there on the fringes of Irish politics. Most of my research is actually on migration. So we have a far right in Ireland. They're tiny. There are certain figures out there who would love to take all the people who have slightly conservative values, all the people who are upset about progressive or woke things, get annoyed at things on the internet, and all the people who are upset about immigration and roll them all into a ball and create a sort of a Trumpian movement. But in reality, these are very, very different things. And the danger is that if you have progressive voices in charge who appear intolerant, is that basically it will fuel a backlash. And the tendency to polarize on one side is mirrored on the other side. And it's not really helpful to most of the rest of us who are trying, who are in the middle, want to be try and find our way through the thicket of very complicated social issues.
Hold that thought for a moment. We want to take a very quick break just to remind our listeners that they can subscribe to irishtimes.com at irishtimes.com/subscribe. We'll be back after this. And I'm speaking with Brian Fanning about his book, Public Morality and the Culture Wars. Brian, I'm sure there are some people listening to this who will say, what are they talking about? The people who are driving the culture wars are not liberals and they're not really progressives. It's actually you touched on it there just before the break. It's populist, reactionary, right-wing movements in countries like the United States. It's places, parties like the Rassemblement National in France. It's fascism is on the rise in many Western democracies in a way which wasn't anticipated 20 years ago. A few rows between liberals and progressives are I suppose, you know, blowing this part of the culture wars out of proportion. It's not where the real action is.
No. And I mean, I did this book a couple of years ago, Diverse Republic, and essentially, you know, looking at basically what Ireland, perhaps where it is in terms of constituting a diverse republic made up of people who are ethnically diverse, and we've experienced a lot of immigration and so on. But as part of that, I kind of looked at the far right at the time, it's only a year or two ago, so slightly before the current sort of events around, say, refugees, but I wouldn't change my mind on pretty much anything I've said in the book. There are people who feel kind of left behind and discombobulated by social changes. And if they feel disrespected, you've got a problem. And this is the key issue. I think a lot of the issues arise when people are led to believe that they are being disrespected. Now, you know, a democratic society, you go with the majority view. You know, the Irish people will be right in the next election. Whoever they choose to go for, they will have made their decision, and that would be the legitimate government of the country. But if that government then, or any other government or any other majority, kind of overtly or appears to disrespect a minority, or can be, or the minorities can be told by various commentators that they are being disrespected, then that can have traction. So in a sense, we've moved from a situation where basically people were very respectful of religion, especially Catholicism. I mean, I remember Bertie Ahern, he'd always go on the news as Taoiseach. He'd always have ash on his forehead on Ash Wednesday. He showed respect. I don't know what his own personal beliefs were in terms of religion, but he wanted to signal respect to every church-going voter in Ireland who might vote Fianna Fáil at the time. You won't find the current Irish political party leader doing anything like that, nor perhaps should they. But the issue is, do people perceive themselves as being disrespected? The whole idea in other countries, are the argument about the rise of populism, which is usually focused on anti-immigrant stuff, or anti-globalization. In other words, the fast pace of change is that people who don't seem to be able to benefit from change, such as kind of former industrial areas, the Rust Belt of America, parts of northern France, and so on and so forth, that people there feel left behind by social and economic change. And the enemies for them are the people who espouse cosmopolitan and socially liberal and progressive views, who are living in a highly capitalistic society but doing well out of it, or seem to be doing comparatively well. And then they're telling the poor left behinds that those folk are intolerant or racist or homophobic or whatever. So those things can backfire. So the challenge, and I think it's an easier one to meet in a small country like Ireland, where social cohesion is rather good, is that the challenge is not to treat large numbers of people with disrespect in getting the good things you want to achieve over the line. So I would sort of say they're listening. So we have a situation.
I mean, this is couched very often in terms of a backlash against elites. We live in sophisticated societies, which are the majority of their economic output these days is based upon the knowledge industries of one sort or another. And a lot of the perception is that in those left behind communities you talk about is that regardless of the democratic outcome of an election, the control of real power in universities, in the media, in the tech industry and various other things is absolutely dominated by people whose values they do not share and who do not respect them, as you say.
Yeah. So that issue of respect is quite important. I mean, if we look at the actual far right in Ireland, I mean, and I really get a bit unnerved when I see commentators refer to large swathes of the Irish population as somehow the far right. But there are small far right parties who nowhere in Ireland in the last general election did they get over 2%, really, and only in a couple of places. It's very unlikely that any figures associated with them, could be front of house, could be basically electable, you know, in local authorities or anything like that. Certainly not in a general election. So, but beyond that, there perhaps are a significant number of Irish people who are politically homeless at the moment. And I could be, by some reckonings, up to 30%. So, you know, it is, you know.
So that's an opportunity for somebody.
That's an opportunity for somebody to step into the vacuum. So if you kind of follow sites like Ripped.ie, which is John McGurk's kind of, you know, people call that far right, but I would sort of say it's right. You know, they would be kind of wondering is, you know, is there some way of pulling some of these issues together? Are there certain ways of coalescing the dissatisfaction that many people feel with perhaps what they see as institutionalization of progressive values, very much tied into basically highly educated people, urban, secular, anti-religious, and so on and so forth. Can these things be pulled together? Also linked to concerns about migration, concerns about globalization, and so on and so forth. So in Ireland, we haven't had that happen yet, and we're unlikely to see it happen at the next general election, because we know what the polls look like. For example, we know where the different parties are, and there's no particular group looking like it will break through.
But this is a society, it's not always true, but this is a society which values consensus very highly,
it seems to me.
Like you talk about social change in the book, and one of the things I found striking, particularly after your discussion of how the previous Catholic theocratic state operated, was when we got around to having referendums and constitutional and social change. I think of something like the marriage equality referendum. A lot of people on the pro-marriage equality side, or some people, felt that you didn't need a referendum at all. You know, that this was a human right that everybody should have access to, regardless of their sexual orientation, and that there was something wrong with having to go and beg the people for it. Now, we did end up with this situation where it was a triumphant success, and we paraded ourselves around the world as being people who voted for this. We were the first people to actually vote for it. But in a way, those people had a bit of an argument, didn't they? It was a human right. They should have been granted it anyway. They shouldn't have had to wait for the gracious decision of the majority of the Irish people.
I mean, a lot of the book is about public morality is a legal concept. And the debate that started the literature on this was the 1960s. And it was a response by a guy called Herbert Hart, a law professor, to the Wolfson Committee report. And the Wolfson Committee report in the very beginning in 1960s advocated for the decriminalisation of homosexuality, which occurred in Britain. So they decriminalised homosexuality at a time when Britain was highly homophobic and remained so, like most Western countries, or all Western countries, or all countries, for many, many decades. So you decriminalised homosexuality, but you didn't change the underlying, if you will, positive law of value. In other words, the majority consensus was still basically homophobic. So what happened in practice, according to Hart and others, was that other laws were retasked to basically, if you will, persecute homosexuals a bit. So there was an offence against public morals, which dates back to the English Civil War. But so now the offence against public morality was now holding hands with somebody who was a same-sex person, you know, in public. So that was now an offence against public morals. So judges found a new offence against that homosexuals and gay people could be charged with, and they got away with that because the law basically tends to reflect not just what's written on the page, but the interpretations of law tend to reflect the dominant social values of the time. So if social values change, the law needs to catch up, but the law can't do things without the consensus. And similarly in politics,
what happens if the law goes ahead of the social values?
Well, that's what happened in Britain with the decriminalisation of homosexuality, which of course didn't occur in Ireland until the 1990s. So in a sense there, what happened was that basically gay people continued to experience quite a lot of discrimination for many, many decades until, if you will, social attitudes sufficiently changed that you could get political candidates saying, I support gay people, I support LBG rights, and so on and so forth, you know? So shifting ideas were also necessary. We are societies. You know, our laws confer rights. But again, coming back to, if you want to look at a certain theory of law, you say, my rights should be inalienable. But I would sort of say, your rights are what's written down. You can't say, if you say I have human rights, and I say, show me your human rights. That was Bentham's big idea, that human rights were nonsense on stilts. Show me your rights. Did you bring them into the room with you? Your rights only exist insofar as people have agreed to follow rules that your rights exist. It's certainly one way of thinking about it. Unless you call to a philosophical point of view, like say you're a Christian who believes that all life is sacred, or you have some belief that basically, and the universal equality of all human beings. These are beliefs, these are values, but they are sometimes encoded. And if they're shared by enough people, they help a lot.
But is it not true that in some societies, for, you know, arising out of political events, that, you know, laws are introduced to change the moral code of society and to ban certain practices, whether it be some of the hate speech stuff that you were talking about earlier,
or even smoking.
So that's part of the apparatus of the state.
So in essence, what you always have people who are essentially trying to drive the car or influence the direction of travel. So you can basically introduce laws that are designed to, if you will, sculpt or reconfigure public opinion. You can make it easier for somebody to be, to, you know, the big idea about having a Catholic public morality in Ireland, and you mentioned it yourself at the intro here, was that if you, Catholic laws made it easier for Catholics to follow the kinds of values that would basically enable them to live good lives according to Catholic beliefs and so on and so forth. So if you, you'd have less divorces or less marital breakdowns if there was no divorce allowed by law. So in essence, the purpose of the law was, in that context, was to avoid occasions of sin, you know, it was to basically design them out of the picture. But now, but we have laws, we have many laws that try and do that. And sometimes they appear unpopular when they come in, but, and sometimes things seem pioneering or progressive.
Sometimes they don't work, like prohibition in the United States.
Prohibition, which is one, an example I have in the book. The book is not just about sex and gender, far, far from it. It's about a whole range of issues. But one of my chapters looks at how Catholics and Protestants responded very differently in the United States and elsewhere to the argument that alcohol should be prohibited. The Catholic Church didn't support it at all. Why? Because the Catholic view was that, essentially it's an Aristotelian view, Thomas Aquinas, folk like that would have articulated as well. Look, God made everything. God made the trees. God made the wheat. God made the beer. And if beer is good until we abuse it. And where basically kind of Protestant morality in the late 19th century, which was basically known as progressive and woke as well, where you had basically early feminists going in and smashing up pubs and taverns, you know, with a vehemence that would perhaps frighten the living bejesus out of us today, but they were doing so because they wanted to smash the demon drink, and that was sufficiently influential in the 1920s to get prohibition over the line in America and something akin to it in a lot of Protestant majority countries, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, kind of the Nordic ones and so on. So kind of, yes, I mean, the argument there is we solve the evils of alcohol, we will prohibit alcohol. And that backfired in certain kinds of ways. But we would have similar arguments about drugs, we'd have similar arguments about many things that haven't got to do with, say, sex or gender, about what the law could or should do. The law is what the main instrument that government has. You know, America, if you read an American newspaper, they always refer to parliamentarians, RTDs or MPs, as lawmakers. And that's what they are. They go into the parliament and they make laws. That's all they do. They may claim to be doing a whole bunch of other things, but essentially they're there to make the laws and pass the laws.
So that raises a question which I think a lot of people touch on when they discuss culture wars. I mean, I look across the Atlantic at the moment and there's a set of pretty strange laws coming onto the statute books of a lot of American states, Republican-controlled states, in relation to what can or cannot be taught in schools, what can be in libraries, what parents are allowed to do or not do with their children, so on and so forth. And that's an extremely interventionist, in some ways anti-conservative approach to implementing conservatism.
Conservatives left neoliberalism behind. The conservatives now, the sort of conservatives like DeSantis or others, are very much in favour of an interventionist state.
So the challenge, it seems to me, for liberals is that they're under attack from both sides, I suppose. And you have this American-originated movements, one of which is this kind of revanchist neoconservatism, very a lot of religiosity involved in it, certainly in the claims that it makes, and also this kind of quasi-religious progressive movement as well. Both seem to be rooted in the United States, perhaps not surprisingly, because it tends to be a more religiously inclined place than most of Europe these days.
I think it's a very complicated question to give a short or simple answer to. But certainly previous generations of kind of, if you will, a certain type of progressivism that the acronym, it's not an acronym, but the thing woke is used to refer to and denigrate, that kind of harks back to religious awakenings. And there were several revivalist religious awakenings during the 19th and early 20th centuries that basically led to social movements that, for example, banning alcohol and things like that. So these were religious movements, but they were also reforming movements, and they were progressive movements in the sense that they wanted social justice and they wanted lots of things like that. Now, they were fundamentally different than what we have now in the United States, say, on the left, because it was very bound up with basically Christianity. So we have that sort of style of operation there. We have that style of operation there. But there is a sort of a sense that I don't know where I'm going with this at all, really. The conservatives, American conservatism just seems to keep shifting all the time. I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was the Tea Party. There clearly always have been a religious bloc of religious conservatives in the Democratic Party since the time of Reagan, since the time really when the Democrats lost the South and the Southern Baptists and the moral majority thing came to be. at that time. It's reinvented itself a number of times. But within American conservatism also, they have the unlikely allies of libertarians. And what you see now with some of the more interesting, well, the more intellectually interesting conservative writers is basically now they're looking at the libertarians and saying, I don't really think these guys...
No, they don't like them at all.
I don't think they want what we want at the end of the day.
No, because there's a kind of communitarian religious conservatism, which is opposed to everything that libertarians stand for, isn't there?
So basically the libertarians would probably end up somewhere else in the political spectrum down the line.
But I suppose without going down the rabbit hole too much of how American politics, it is a rabbit hole of how American politics works, because they have a system which makes it impossible to have anything other really than a two-party system, those two parties are vast, rather ramshackle, contradictory
and huge local
coalitions of
Texas is not New Hampshire.
Of one sort or another. Just another point I wanted to raise is some people, when they look at this, they see these arguments, these absolutely ferocious arguments, which may be over issues which affect a very small number of people. Yeah. And I would acknowledge they affect those people very deeply.
They do.
But they're a very small minority of the population. Why are they so salient? Why do they take up so much oxygen? And some people suggest it's because they have a symbolic value as much as they have a real value for the people directly involved.
Yes.
And you talk about things like generational change or contestation between different elites. Those kind of things are going on as well.
I think so. And I think, you know, when I look at, you know, I kind of look at, say, things such as, say, pride marches, which have become, you know, have changed over a period. I mean, once upon a time, it was a handful of very, very brave gay and lesbian queer people who marched defiantly down the street. Now it's a carnival that pretty much embraces very large proportions of society. I think a lot of people look at issues, I mean, it's a personal opinion, it's not scientifically tested, but just from talking to people and to younger people, you know, I think a lot of people see, they may not be transgender themselves, but they see in this basically some aspect of what an aspiration to a good society could be, a society that's inclusive in new ways, in ways in which their parents' generations haven't managed. And that's what every generation must do. Every generation must find its way forward. Every generation must and should be idealistic. Every generation must add its piece to the human story. So in a sense, they can't do that by basically going over ground that perhaps was steps that were taken in the 1970s or 80s or elsewhere. So basically, I do think there's a lot of idealism. I think a lot of people basically who are perhaps not directly connected with these issues feel very, very strongly about them, because when they hear about these debates, they actually see, they can identify this because this is an effort to create a kind of a good society. So from that point of view, these ideas, we wouldn't be talking about them unless a lot of people were drawn to them. And a lot of people are drawn to them because they genuinely basically might be genuinely idealistic about some of the values of tolerance, of inclusion, of diversity understood in certain ways that these ideas stand for. And some of the people who perhaps are the most vehement in the culture wars, I would imagine are not necessarily kind of transgender people themselves, but are people who identify politically with the ideas and aspirations and so on. And that's an entirely understandable thing. That's an entirely understandable thing and a good thing.
We'll leave it there. Brian, thanks very much for joining us. Public Morality and the Culture Wars is published by Emerald Publishing. That's it for today. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon. We'll be back with you very soon indeed. Until then, goodbye and thanks for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.